The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Today on the Town Hall Review, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, the much-ballyhooed midterm election of 2018 is finally behind us.
There was no blue wave. We beat the odds of history.
We'll examine the results.
We're living in fascinating times. The country is splitting tickets, going in so many different directions.
What happened to get us here?
Do you realize this was the first election in our memory that the media didn't complain about too much money being spent on politics?
And what's next?
2020 has begun. Every Democrat under the sun is running for president. And I just hope the silliness of that doesn't distract from actually getting work done in Congress.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live at 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. Midterm elections are always nearly a highlight for the party out of power. The president's party can count on losing quite a few seats. And while Republicans did indeed lose the House, the margin was much slimmer than some had predicted. The blue wave came in on a low tide. The big plus for the Republicans, however, came in the Senate, where the GOP managed to pick up seats, a rarity for the party in power during the midterms. The morning after the election, while many close races were still being decided, I spoke with Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post. Republicans lost the House, kind of expected that, but I did not see picking up three, four Senate seats. And I am so happy that McSally, Braun, Hawley, DeSantis, Scott DeWine, Mimi Walter, Kevin Cramer, Ted Cruz, Matt Rosendale's ahead. Marsha Blackburn won. We will see, joined now by Robert Costa. He, the host of Washington Week in Review with The Washington Post. You can follow him on Twitter at Costa Reports. I see him at MSNBC and NBC all the time. All right. So I'm going to be watching you, and I expect you to say this has been an interesting 40 years, but the most interesting period of time was 2015 through 2020. Do you agree with me?
Oh, I think for sure. I mean, you just got to look at the map and say we're living in fascinating times. This country is splitting tickets, going in so many different directions.
What surprised you the most?
Well, I think you got to be surprised at Republican strength in Florida, Ohio, and then you think about the gubernatorial races Republicans won in those states, in maybe even winning a race in Connecticut, keeping the governor's mansion in Massachusetts and Maryland. That's not getting enough attention. But you also think the suburbs are going to the Democrats' way. I think, look, this country didn't turn on President Trump in a significant way. It turned slightly against him. And you got Republicans having some core strength in certain states and Democrats coming back in core states.
I just think it sets up 2020 for one of the most interesting two-year cycles I have seen in my long career broadcasting. Let me tell you, Shane Goldmacher was on and brought me news, which I did not know, that the New York State Senate destroyed the Republicans. That means there will be no check on redistricting in the Empire State. So Florida and Texas will redistrict with Republican governors, but California and New York, it's going to be lethal for Republicans up there, Robert Costa. Anyone done a deep dive yet on the redistricting implications?
Look, it's major redistricting implications because the Democrats coming back in a lot of these states, not wholesale, but in a significant way, really matters. Because you think back to 2006, 2010, generations of rising Democrats, their careers destroyed by Republican waves. Democrats finally getting some traction in state legislatures, getting back some governor's mansions, maybe looking like they won in Wisconsin, the Walker has and conceded, winning in Michigan. You see Democrats starting to say, hey, we can start to build a ground team again.
And in fact, if you look at the Democrats who emerged, I think those on the Senate Judiciary Committee may have taken a hit in their presidential aspirations because, and I'll confirm or deny, agree or disagree, I saw a Kavanaugh effect that's about as obvious as a banner flying over the beach at San Clemente. What do you think?
Kavanaugh was certainly a base motivator, but the more I've talked to voters and consultants, the strong economy, even though wages are flat for some people, the strong economy really helped lift the Republican votes this time. Kavanaugh confirmation. Some consultants I talked to say it was kind of a wash. It motivated Democrats as much as it really ginned up Republican enthusiasm. And so you see the economy, though, it's been hard for the Democrats running hard on economic populism and health care to really get significant major inroads with Republicans.
Okay, just 1 minute ago, the President of the United States tweeted again. In all fairness, writes the President, Nancy Pelosi deserves to be chosen Speaker of the House by the Democrats. If they give her a hard time, perhaps we will add some Republican votes. She has earned this great honor. He's trolling Nancy Pelosi, Robert Costa.
Oh, this is going to be the relationship to watch. I have a story in today's Post about this. Will President Trump cut deals with Pelosi? She signaled already. She wants to work with him on pre-existing conditions, maybe even on infrastructure. The president could be tempted. He's cut a lot of deals with the conservatives, gotten a lot done, but maybe it's time to move a little bit toward the center, see if they can make a deal.
Look, I think there's a deal on regularization for most of the population in the country without permission in exchange for a long, tall, double-sided fence. I really do think that's there. I think a military rebuild for the Navy is there as well. There are deals to be done. It's a question of whether or not the president will do it. And I think Mitch McConnell will do it, provided he gets his judges. Let's turn there. We need a White House counsel. Lindsey Graham's probably going to get the gavel of judiciary. Do you think, Robert Costa, the pace keeps up or even quickens on judicial appointments?
Oh, the big win for the Republicans in the Senate means Mitch McConnell just continues to move forward to do what he needs to do. He looks at the map and he says, I'm empowered right now. Why not just keep moving on all these judicial appointments? And it's going to stop any kind of impeachment from ever becoming a trial that convicts the president, that Senate majority.
Even before the races were decided, the spin began. Democrats tried to downplay losing seats in the Senate, but clearly that stung. Dennis Prager spoke with John Fund, columnist for the National Review.
So, John, how should my many listeners who are Republican react to yesterday?
Probably with a sigh of relief. It could have been a whole lot worse, given what the polls have been showing for months and the incredible amount of money that was spent in this election. I think the most interesting dog that didn't bark, to quote the Sherlock Holmes story, was, do you realize, Dennis, this was the first election in our memory that the media didn't complain about too much money being spent on politics?
What a great point, John.
Because it all came from media billionaires, right, like Michael Bloomberg.
Do we overestimate the importance of money in elections?
Yes, because there's so many ads in races where the most money is spent, a lot of people just tune it out. In other words, they reach a saturation point, and they simply say, all these ads are just lying. I'm not going to spend the time figuring out which one is which.
Yes, I would seem to suggest that. I mean, the Steyer money, the Bloomberg money that went into it, the wealthy class, is there anybody that you could name? Who in the wealthy class? I mean, there's the Koch brothers, I understand. But the wealthy class seems to be overwhelmingly Democrat. Is that fair to say?
The wealthy class that has the money that they're willing to spend because they know they're not going to get social opprobrium, social criticism from
right,
it.
Right.
The reason why the Koch brothers are pretty much off to their own, along with Sheldon Adelson, is that most, first of all, public companies would never do that. Private billionaires will do that, and because they favor climate change regulation, and because they favor abortion, they favor, you know, drug legalization and prison reform and all of these other things, they know they're not going to be criticized in the media. But if a conservative steps forward, they're running into a machine gun fire nest. And I think there are a lot of people who are simply, you know, I have my money. I'm going to spend it to try to save my country, but I'm going to be criticized as being some kind of a monster. No, thank you. The left media millionaires, with the exception of being attacked by people on the radio, I mean, they're not going to be criticized mainstream media for this.
That's right. So in light of all of that, you said it could have been a lot worse. So give us a plausible, not an apocalyptic, a plausible worse scenario.
Well, that the Democrats had not engaged in that ridiculous, absurd, frightening Brett Kavanaugh mugging, If they had not done that, I think we could have seen Senate seats lost, like in Arizona, which was very, very close, like in Florida, which was very, very close. That would have brought the Republicans down to 51 or 50 seats even, maybe even more. Maybe there could have been another loss somewhere else. So I think that was a bullet escape. The House, if you look at the very, very closest races, the Republicans probably are leading in two out of three of the most close races. You know, that's luck of the draw. Governors, there were some governors who survived that very, very tight races, such as Georgia, Florida, Iowa. Those were largely fought, I think, on local issues, more a little bit more than on the congressional front. If Republicans had lost Florida, which is the nation's third largest state, it would have been a catastrophe, but they didn't.
Well, that's interesting. So here, this is, I don't know if you could even answer it, but you're the guy I would like to ask this of. Do you think there are five or three or one Democratic senator who says to his or her spouse, maybe we shouldn't have humiliated Kavanaugh?
Well, I have talked to Republican senators who have had that conversation with some Democrats in the cloakroom or off campus. And yes, they know what they did was wrong, but who's going to admit it? And anyone who would admit it would be completely ostracized and drummed out of the Democratic caucus.
It could have been a lot worse for Republicans. Totally agree with you on that. The president made a point that I'd like you to react to. I thought it was an intelligent point. If the Republicans had retained the House by a margin of 3, 4, 5 votes, you would never get unanimity anyway, so that actually could have hurt the Republican Party. A reaction to that?
Well, you could always put a silver lining on everything, and that is a plausible argument. However, the fact of the matter is the Democratic subpoena power, the Democratic investigations, the headline-seizing stunts that they will pull are not going to help the country. Now, maybe they will decide to actually work with the president on an infrastructure bill. Maybe they will work with the president on repairing small parts of Obamacare. But I doubt it. I think that the Democratic base is so angry, so embittered, and so many of the new Democrats coming in are left-wingers, that they're going to go immediately into confrontation mode. And, of course, the president, with his personality, will meet them immediately with twice the firepower. So I don't think it really mattered that much, but I do think that the Democrats, since nothing was going to be done, I would have preferred that the Republicans kept the subpoena and the investigative power.
Go to townhallreview.com for the rest of the interview and sign up for the podcast. You'll get the best of talk radio every day. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
2020 has begun. Every Democrat under the sun is running for president. And I just hope the silliness of that doesn't distract from actually getting work done in Congress.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The day after taking the House, the Democrats were back to calling for impeachment of President Donald Trump. Polls show the public does not want that, so the party managed to keep the plan quiet before voting took place on Tuesday. But the voting is done now, the results are in, and the gloves are off. Congressman Mike Gallagher survived his race in Wisconsin by nearly doubling the votes his opponent received. Yes, way up there in Wisconsin. He won more than 60% of the vote. The morning after the election, he joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Hey, look, the NRCC didn't do the greatest job. They spent $5 million on Barbara Comstock. And, you know, I never had her on because I love Barbara, but I just didn't think it was doable. And I look around at Mike Kaufman. I didn't think that was doable. They spent a lot of money on Mike Kaufman. I just didn't think it was doable. And yet Scott Taylor was doable. And there are a few others that are doable. But tell me what do you hear now about how the Republicans go forward? Because I think actually the Democrats are going to have to work with us, or they're going to end up getting crushed in 2020. And I think they can work with us on border security and military stuff.
Well, I do think it's a moment of truth for the Democratic Party, right? I mean, there's sort of two paths diverging in the woods. One leads towards Ocasio-Cortez and socialist oblivion, and the other is the let's make a good faith effort to work with the Republicans. And I think there are a couple issues that stand out where there could be the possibility of working together across the aisle. Oh, let me say three issues. Well, first is the continuing rebuild and modernization of the American military, which we heard the administration is planning on requesting a 5% cut from all departments, including the Pentagon. That would be a disaster for the Pentagon. That would kill the rebuild in the crib before it gets started. And so I am eager to work with my colleagues on the Armed Services Committee, like Jimmy Panetta, like Tom Suozzi and other, and Stephanie Murphy, in order to avoid that. Second is a conversation about infrastructure. I think we all recognize that we need to make an investment in our infrastructure. The challenge is how you pay for it, but that's a conversation I'm eager to have as a new member of the Transportation Infrastructure Committee. And then finally, there are a lot of obscure conversations to be had about how you fix the House as an institution. How do you restore regular order? How do you get debate happening again? How do you get individual members to have a stake in the process? And how do you devolve power and authority from leadership back down to the committees and the members? And until you do that, until you fix the process, it's my belief that neither party is going to be able to confront the real big issues looming on the horizon. We'll just punt on that. So that is the optimistic case going forward. That being said, you know, 2020 has begun. Every Democrat under the sun is running for president. And I just hope the silliness of that doesn't distract from actually getting work done in Congress.
Well, now we're going to have two leadership elections. We're going to have a leadership election for Nancy Pelosi. And I don't know that she comes out of that okay. I really don't know if she has to make a deal to give up after 6 months in order to satisfy. A lot of people ran in her party saying they would not support her as speaker. But then we've got the redoubtable Kevin McCarthy, good friend of mine. I think when you're in the minority, you need a healer. You need someone to bring everyone together and speak with one voice. I hope it's Kevin. What do you think happens on both sides of the aisle with the leadership teams?
I agree with your analysis on Pelosi. I do not think it's a foregone conclusion that she will be speaker, although it's probably the most likely outcome. I think she could face a revolt on her hands. Certainly the best thing that could happen for Republicans in terms of retaking the House would be for her to be speaker. I just think it's a bad look for the Democratic Party, and they would be wise to nominate someone younger, someone like Tim Ryan or something like that. On our side, I'm hoping that we have a very open debate about what we've done so far, where we've fallen short, and how we need to fix the process going forward. My hope is that whoever runs for leadership will have a comprehensive plan to fix the institution, to get the House working again, so that we're not just, you know, endless campaign, endless tribal warfare all the time. People are doing their jobs and focusing on their committee work.
How do you think the president walks into his reelection campaign, which is now underway?
Listen, I think some of it's going to be dictated by where the Democrats choose to go. And if this election was any indication, if they go down the path of Medicare for all, single-payer health care, if it's abolish ICE, if it's open borders, if it's, you know, take your pick, and if they sort of initiate impeachment proceedings in the House, then certainly it becomes easy to counter that message. I do think, however, we as Republicans need to take a hard look at healthcare policy and recognize that while Medicare for All is a disaster, while single-payer healthcare is a disaster, we need a bold, positive vision for healthcare in this country because the issue is not going away.
Now tell me a little bit about who is going to run Armed Services.
It would be Adam Smith will take over Armed Services, most likely, not to be confused with Adam Schiff. Or the, you know, conservative economist Adam Smith. I had a debate with him at the Reagan National Defense Forum last year about this very issue, about the fact that mandatory spending was crowding out entitlements. And it seemed during that debate he was of the opinion that DOD would need to be prepared to take a cut unless we were willing to, you know, raise taxes on rich people, which I think is a simplistic argument that doesn't withstand closer scrutiny. But we'll see.
From one Mike Gallagher to the next, Salem host Mike Gallagher gave his analysis of the vote the day after.
Tuesday night was certainly not a complete win for Republicans, but of course, even the Washington Post is forced to concede there was no blue wave. And if the goal of Democrats was to reject the president of the United States. The way to do it was with the blue wave, and there was no blue wave. We beat the odds of history. Millions and millions of Americans voted for President Trump because of the gamble that he would fulfill his promise and appoint conservatives to the judiciary. With the Senate firmly controlled by the Republicans, that continues. And that's going to affect our grandchildren. We're going to continue to see conservative upon conservative appointed to the federal judiciary. You got two 80-something-year-old Supreme Court justices. We will see a solidly conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. It was a very good night for President Trump. He undoubtedly saw to it that in Florida, the victories occurred. He brought Ron DeSantis and Rick Scott across the finish line. He fought hard in Florida. Democrats had their sights set on Stacey Abrams in Georgia. Incidentally, boy, is she being graceful. She's not conceding. Stacey Abrams, the Oprah-endorsed candidate for Georgia governor, is refusing to concede to Brian Kemp, despite a large deficit in the vote count. Now, I'm sorry, that's kind of comical. So much for the Oprah effect, huh? How did Taylor Swift do with her endorsement of Phil Bredesen in Tennessee? Oh, yeah, Marsha Blackburn shellacked him. Marsha Blackburn clobbered him. I guess Taylor Swift doesn't have an impact. There was, and of course, we will absolutely not forget Texas. Beto O'Rourke, the darling, the grand poobah of the Hollywood left. They love this guy. He's the next Bobby Kennedy. Look at him. He's charismatic. He cusses. He rides a skateboard. Oh, yeah, he cusses. Last night, his concession speech, he literally got up on stage and said, "I'm so effing proud of all of you guys." Well, real classy guy. That's cool, though, because he's hip. If you use the F word, you're hip, right, Beto? Well, he went down to defeat Senator Ted Cruz.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com. Coming up.
These are women who are sleeping in one big room, 3 to 5 feet from each other, and Anchorage is talking about putting a biological male in that situation.
Another big case for the Alliance Defending Freedom when the Town Hall Review continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. We talk a good deal about the Alliance Defending Freedom, and not just because they are a sponsor of our program, but because they take on the central cases free of charge. They've argued religious liberty cases before the Supreme Court, and they've won. The Masterpiece Cake Shop verdict is one we've heard a great deal about. But there's another that has been flying under the radar that is extremely important to the faith-based community. A women's shelter in Alaska has been told they must allow biological males to stay there overnight, so long as those males identify as women. Dennis Prager spoke with Alliance Defending Freedom Senior Legal Counsel Kate Anderson.
You guys do great work. I adore you. I support you personally. So you get lawyers to protect religious freedom. I mean, folks, you're now going to hear a story that even 10 years ago would have struck you as impossible. So tell everybody the case you're covering, you're providing legal counsel for in Alaska.
Well, this case is about the ability of a homeless shelter to operate according to their beliefs, and those are beliefs that motivate the good work that they do. I represent the Hope Center in Anchorage, Alaska, and the Hope Center provides a biological women's-only overnight facility on a long-term basis for the women in Alaska. These women that come to the shelter, many of them have escaped domestic violence, sex trafficking, and all kinds of abuse. And they come to the shelter, the Hope Center, because it provides them a safe and private place to sleep.
Right. And under the rather understandable assumption that they will be with other women only.
Absolutely, and that's the heart of this case. Anchorage is trying to force the Hope Center to allow biological men into the shelter with these women.
This is akin to biological men running in women's races.
Yes, there is some relationship here, and this particular issue came up because an individual, a man, who identifies as a woman, came to the shelter seeking to stay overnight. He was intoxicated, and he was clearly injured from being in a fight earlier in the night. So the Hope Center paid for his taxi to get him to the hospital to get the care that he needed, but that triggered Anchorage to come after the Hope Center for not allowing him to come into the shelter.
This is Orwellian, and they did so in the guise of human rights.
Yes, they did. And what's especially odd in this case is that the Hope Center has served this individual before and would serve him again. Among the good work that they do, they provide a soup kitchen, food for the homeless, they provide shower facilities, they provide a laundry service, and they provide job skills training. He had already received food and showers on occasions before this, and he can anytime again.
But not in the women's shelter.
Correct. At night, the Hope Center becomes a women's shelter, and they only take in women, biological women, and it's because...
So I just want to make it clear to people, there are a lot of things going on here. One is, this is what the left has done to the United States. The irony is, it is the antithesis of giving battered and sexually abused women a shelter. The last thing that these women want in their privacy at night is a man with a penis. I mean, let's be clear here that I don't deny he identifies as a woman, and if his name were Michelle, I'd call him Michelle and I'd say her. I don't have any gripe against this person. I want to protect women who have been, you even mentioned, sex trafficked. I can't think of a bigger sexual trauma than that. And now they, because there's a male body that says I'm a female, they have to sleep next to him?
Yes, that's what's going on here. And I've talked to many of the women in the shelter, and they explain the physical and emotional consequences for them if they're faced with a biological male in their sleeping quarters. These are women who are sleeping in one big room 3 to 5 feet from each other, and Anchorage is talking about putting a biological male in that situation.
Right. Because the left is humane. You don't have to comment on that. I am editorializing. I care about ADF. Right now, that's what I want people. This is the type of case. These women, this shelter doesn't have the money to go to court, okay? Anchorage has unlimited funds, as every state capital, every government does. They could sue till the cows come home. But the people who ADF supply the lawyers to, they don't have the money. So the banner is up at DennisPrager.com.
Coming up, Tyler Spady was in the Borderline Bar in Thousand Oaks when terror broke out on Wednesday night.
This is the scene inside the Borderline Bar just moments after a gunman opened fire. Terrified patrons took cover and escaped as soon as they had a chance.
There are multiple shots being fired.
The bar was packed with a crowd of 100 young people who had come for college country night.
I started walking toward the bar where the shooter was, and as I was walking that way, I started hearing shots in front of me, and immediately I knew that it was a handgun.
He joins me next when we return. Welcome back. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Tyler Spady is the son of a friend of the Salem Radio Network and TownHallReview.com. David Spady. Tyler was in the bar, Borderline Bar, in Thousand Oaks when terror broke out on Wednesday night.
There are multiple shots being fired in the back northwest area.
He joined me on my program Thursday morning. Tyler, first, I'm very, very grateful that you are okay. How you feeling?
Very shook up and just in a surreal state of mind. I mean, I've been going to this place for about 2 years now.
Well, Tyler, let's begin. And I'm very, very grateful that you're fine and your sister is fine. We know there are 11 victims. We know the shooter is dead. Tell us a little bit about Borderline Bar, where it is and what it looks like on the inside.
Well, it's a country bar in Ventura County by Thousand Oaks area, and it is laid out with a dance floor, and then on the other side there's a kitchen and a bar.
So, Tyler, the average age in there, what are you, about 22?
So it was college night, so there was anywhere from 18 years old to 26 years old.
Okay, and how old are you, Tyler?
I'm 23.
Okay, and your sister often goes to this bar with you as well, but she totaled the car earlier today, I'm told. So, to the grace of God and a fender bender, she's fine from that, and she wasn't at the bar.
Yes, thank goodness, too, because I'm not sure. I mean, if my sister was in there, it might have been different circumstances of me getting out. So I'm very thankful that she was at home, and prayers out to anyone who was affected.
So let's talk about how big Borderline is.
I would say that it's fairly big. It's got about the size of a diner restaurant. It's got a pretty large area for dancing and then hallways on each side.
And is it line dancing? Is it sort of country and western line dancing on country night or college night?
Yes, country and line dancing, yes.
And so how many people were in there when you were there?
Thankfully, less than usually on the college nights. It was probably about 150 people.
Wow, that's actually quite a lot of people. So we got about 100 to 150 college kids and young adults in their flannel shirts. I've seen a lot of you dressed up. What were you wearing, Tyler?
I was wearing just normal clothes. I had a long sleeve flannel on and jeans and boots. So
what happened, or what do you recall happening, and at what time did it begin, do you think?
So it was probably 12:30, and I was by the dance floor, and I was going over to meet up back up with my friends. And I started walking toward the bar where the shooter was. And as I was walking that way, I started hearing shots in front of me. And immediately I knew that it was a handgun. I looked up and I saw him shooting in my direction. I turned around and people around me were getting shot at. So I dove over a wall onto some tables and was kicked in the face and trampled on as people were trying to make their way out of the building. And then as I was out of the kitchen, I heard another round of shots. I think he had reloaded the clip at that point, and I thought he was maybe following us, but I wasn't sure. So I got a group of girls and started lifting them over a wall into a neighborhood, and we went house to house trying to get inside a house. And once we were able to get inside, turn the lights off and hide.
Well, quick thinking. Thank you for helping the young ladies. Are you certain it was a handgun and not a long gun?
I'm positive that it was a handgun. He was, as he pointed it at us, it was a handgun.
Yeah, you're familiar with weapons. I know that. And so when you first heard it shooting, you knew it was a high caliber weapon?
I knew it was a high caliber. I knew it wasn't an assault rifle just because of the space in between the shots, but it was semi-automatic and it wasn't as loud as a rifle would have been.
All right. Now, did you get a look at the suspect?
Briefly, I immediately turned around as he pointed at me, but he was in all black. I didn't get a good look at his face. People say that he had a bandana over his face, but I was just more concentrated on getting out of the building.
Okay, so again, how did you exit? Was there, if he's coming through the door, normally is it a one entrance, one exit sort of place?
So there are, I think there are exits through the kitchen. I know that people started to break the windows to get out. Where I was, he was by the front door, so I was not going to go that direction. I ran the opposite way toward the kitchen, and I was hoping there was doors there, but I'd never been through there before.
So, Tyler, in your mind, I've often wondered, and I've spoken to people at the Las Vegas shooting, I've spoken to others, did panic grip you, or did cold, calculating calm descend upon you, I've got to stay alive? What happened in your head?
It was like instinctual, where I just kind of shut down everything and said, once I heard the shots and saw him, I said, okay, well, here we go. We got to get out of here.
Did you see anyone shot?
There was a girl next to me that I think was, I'm not quite sure. I think she went down though.
And how many shots are you fairly certain you heard fired at a minimum?
More than five in each grouping.
Yeah. So we had at least 10 shots.
Yes.
There are 11 victims reported, so he must have reloaded again after you got out or whatever. When you got out and you began running over walls and helping girls over walls, so you exited the kitchen door out into the backyard. Which house did you get in? Who let you in?
So I got into a neighborhood and with these girls, and I started going house to house, and people were afraid to let us in because of the shooting, and they said, we're calling 911. And eventually I was able to get to this man's house who let us inside, and he was just, he was very welcoming and helped us out. But it was in the neighborhood right across the street from Borderline.
How did you get reunited? I know your mom and dad. How did you get reunited with your family? Do you have your cell phone with you?
So I have my cell phone, and I told them not to come because we were not sure if the suspect was still at large, and we were concerned that he might be going through the neighborhoods, and I was right at the neighborhood right next to there. So I had a friend at the bar with me, and his mother went and got him and then was able to come and get me from that neighborhood.
Where do these kids come from? Who goes to the Borderline bar?
All around. I mean, there are kids from Camarillo, Newbury Park, Thousand Oaks, Westlake. It's kind of a community thing where a lot of these people are frequent people that come there very often on the Wednesdays on the college nights. And they're from the surrounding colleges, Cal Lutheran, Channel Islands, and Moore Park.
How many times have you been to the Borderline bar?
I would say probably 100 times.
And have you ever felt that it was a dangerous place?
Never once. I am just in utter shock.
Okay. Well, Tyler, I appreciate the firsthand reporting. I am so grateful to God you're okay, and tell your parents and your sister the same thing. Do they have any security, by the way?
They do. They have a lot of bouncers, and they sometimes have police that come in and sit in.
Well, we will continue to pray for the victims, for the families, and thank you for your heroism, for your courage, and for the calm to call and tell people what it's like. Do you have advice for anyone who ever finds themselves in that situation?
Stay calm and collected and run away from gunfire.
That's about as good an advice as you could possibly ask for. Our prayers go out to all of the victims of the Borderline bar shooting, and our prayer of thanksgiving that Tyler and his family are okay. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, anti-Semitism becomes a problem in America.
Most of the upsurge is on college campuses, and it's from the left.
Michael Medved with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. One of the most disturbing results of Tuesday's election was at least one Democrat elected to the House who is openly anti-Semitic. You wonder how someone who believes as they do could get elected in a country like ours, especially coming so soon after the horrible shooting in the Pittsburgh synagogue. But the reality is there is an accepted form of hate speech, and some victims are not considered victims. Here's my friend and colleague Michael Medved.
One of the things that I find disgusting that makes my blood boil, actually, was that in the wake of the synagogue shooting in Pittsburgh, you had people on both sides trying to point fingers and to blame the other side. It's a disgusting instinct. There are 11 people dead. They were killed by a sick and evil monster who, yes, deserves the death penalty. He will have a trial. He has pleaded not guilty. Hard to imagine how. But meanwhile, you have a case like this, and the instinct of people is to say, no, it's actually, this is the fault. Well, people on the left saying it's President Trump and his harsh rhetoric. Some of President Trump's rhetoric stinks. And yes, that is loathsome. But it is also loathsome to try to make a suggestion that one group or another group is the source of our problems. And here, yes, it is worth recalling some of Nazi history. The official slogan of the early Nazi party was "Die Juden sind unser Unglück," which means the Jews are our misfortune. We get rid of the Jews, we live in paradise. And by the way, you can substitute any name you want. Substitute blacks for Jews. Substitute illegals for Jews. Substitute white males for Jews. And the idea that we get rid of white males, we're in paradise, we're happy because our whole problem is focused on white males. Yes, that is the point of view that Don Lemon at CNN seems to be taking. The other night he made some offhand comments, and now he's doubled down on them. And it's hateful. It is hate speech. It is wildly irresponsible. And it represents the worst of the American left. Here was Don Lemon's original comment, which you may take initially as some kind of a joke, but he doesn't mean it as a joke. He means it as a provocation. Here's Don Lemon on CNN.
I keep trying to point out to people not to demonize any one group or any one ethnicity, but we keep thinking that the biggest terror threat is something else, some people who are marching, you know, towards the border like it's imminent. So we have to stop demonizing people and realize the biggest terror threat in this country is white men, most of them radicalized right, to the right. And we have to start doing something about them. There is no travel ban on them. There is no ban on, you know, they had the Muslim ban. There is no white guy ban. So what do we do about that?
Explain to me why this kind of hate speech is acceptable on CNN or anywhere else.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, and Dwayne Generalissimo Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.